You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the earth. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, March 21st, 2018, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the program. We've got a jam-packed 2 hours of the Marijuana Agenda for you today with plenty of interviews and sound clips galore. So let's get right to it. Coming up in our Pot and Public Policy segment, we're visiting with John J. Hudak. He's a senior fellow for governance studies there at the Brookings Institute. And he's just co-authored a report that takes a look at the South American nation of Uruguay and how their marijuana legalization experience has played out. There's all sorts of lessons for us to learn, both down in Uruguay and up here in North America as Canada looks at legalizing cannabis this summer, and more U.S. states are doing the same. Also coming up on today's program, we'll be speaking with Sarah Frank, a very extended interview with Sarah Frank, the founder of Moms for Marijuana and the director of the Boise Hemp Fest. We talked about all sorts of subjects, including the recent Idaho CBD bill that got sort of secretly canned for a moment by a senator who was up to some shenanigans that proved to be illegal. Also, we take a look at the Boise Hemp Fest itself, the event that's coming up on April 14th at the Julia Davis Bandshell in Boise, Idaho. It's one of the first hemp fests of the year, so it kind of kicks off the season. And in our second hour, we'll continue our discussion with Sarah Frank and talk about her recent arrest and conviction on charges related to her holding of a smokeout protest on the steps of the Idaho Capitol. That's coming up in hour two, so you want to stay tuned for that. Also in hour two, we take a look at Julie Schauer. She was second only to Sheldon Adelson in millionaires who contributed money to try to defeat legalization in 2016. She had some crazy things to say on Twitter over the weekend about mass shooters and marijuana use, and that just has to be addressed. Also, we'll take a look in what in the news at Democrats who are currently saying Donald Trump's idea of death penalty for drug dealers is a bad one, but didn't say that when it was Bill Clinton's idea and they had the chance to vote against it. But first, let's get to the cannabis headline news for the week.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for the week of Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. I'm Russ Belville. Embracing the tough penalties favored by global strongmen, President Donald Trump on Monday brandished the death penalty as a fitting punishment for drug traffickers fueling the opioid epidemic.
But if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
And without a hint of irony, the president, whose attorney general denies any medical benefit to cannabis, called for alternatives to addictive opioids.
That includes increasing federal funding for the development of non-addictive painkillers. And we have to come up with a solution where we come up with a painkiller that's not so addictive.
Trump also took the time to once again falsely assert that the typical drug dealer kills thousands in their career, to denigrate blue ribbon commissions like his own opioid commission, and to completely ignore the role of pharmaceutical industries in the burgeoning opioid overdose crisis. Allowing states to pursue their own marijuana policies free from federal interference is gaining bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. A group of 59 House Republicans and Democrats is pushing congressional leaders to attach a provision to spending legislation that would prevent the Department of Justice from interfering with state marijuana laws. Separately, a bipartisan group of 62 members of Congress sent a letter pushing to extend existing state medical cannabis protections through 2019. And in another letter, 14 lawmakers are asking to defund the Drug Enforcement Administration's Marijuana Eradication Program. At a hearing of the U.S. House Appropriations Subcommittee on Military Construction, Veterans Affairs, and Related Agencies, California Congresswoman Barbara Lee questioned Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin about why the VA refuses to allow its doctors to recommend cannabis in medical marijuana states. Secretary Shulkin seemed unaware of the critical difference between prescriptions, regulated by the federal government, and recommendations, a free speech right of doctors. Voters in the largest county in Illinois overwhelmingly approved a ballot question calling for the legalization of marijuana on Tuesday. The measure in Cook County, the nation's second most populous county, is not binding, but its passage sends a strong message to state lawmakers that ending cannabis prohibition is an issue that voters want the legislature to address. Statewide, voters also went to the polls on Tuesday to select party nominees for governor and attorney general, contests in which the candidates' positions on marijuana legalization has been a key issue. Businessman J.B. Pritzker won the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, and in his victory speech, he vowed to reform the criminal justice system.
And we can begin by immediately removing at least one area of racial injustice in our criminal justice system. Let's legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana.
After a vigorous public relations campaign that included the support of actor Sir Patrick Stewart, the government of the United Kingdom has agreed in principle to allow a six-year-old boy suffering from epilepsy to use cannabis oil. Hannah Deacon and her husband Drew met with Prime Minister Theresa May and other ministers on Tuesday to plead for the right to use the medicine, banned in the UK, to reduce the number of life-threatening seizures her son suffers. They handed a 380,000-strong petition to Downing Street. Little Alfie Deacon is believed to be one of only five boys in the world suffering with his rare form of epilepsy that can cause up to 150 potentially life-threatening seizures a month. How could one not support Alfie, Sir Patrick Stewart said. The Star Trek and X-Men star has arthritis and uses medical cannabis when he is in California to manage his pain. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for the week of Wednesday, March 21st, 2018. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159-855.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Sarah Frank. Join me on Saturday, April 14th for the third annual Boise Hemp Fest at the Julia Davis Park Bandshell in downtown Boise. Join us at Hemp Fest as we educate and entertain the people of Idaho about medical marijuana, industrial hemp, and all the amazing realities about cannabis. We'll have excellent bands, knowledgeable speakers, informative booths, and even a supervised children's play area called Kidland. The Boise Hemp Fest is Saturday, April 14th and begins at 10 a.m. and runs until dark. Visit BoiseHempFest.org today.
The Marijuana Agenda free podcast is available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, SoundCloud, and on our Facebook page at MJ Agenda. Free video archives are available at the Radical Russ channel on YouTube. Help keep this media free by making a donation at paypal.me/Radical Russ.
People can say no to drugs.
It's really, really easy.
Adding more gasoline to the fire.
Lackadaisical.
Really tough, really big, really great to infect and rot our nation.
dangerous and gateway drugs.
We don't need to be legalizing marijuana.
To build and grow a stronger, healthier, and drug-free society.
Today in What in the News, we're examining once again President Trump's call for the death penalty for drug traffickers. He's been bringing this up on the campaign stump. He's been bringing this up in meetings, and he kind of made it official on Monday when he visited New Hampshire and discussed the opioid overdose crisis, saying that we need to get tough on drugs.
But if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So he's been touting the success of various strongmen across the world, in Singapore, in the Philippines. He talks about how he discusses drug issues with them, and they say they have no problem because they have the death penalty.
So we're going to very much, you know, as you know, we've been involved more than any administration by far. It's a problem that's growing, and drugs are a similar but different problem in the sense that we have pushers.
Let me get the right clip there from Donald Trump on talking about the death penalty.
The only way to solve the drug problem is through toughness. When you catch a drug dealer, you gotta put them away for a long time. When I was in China, and other places, by the way, I said, Mr. President, do you have a drug problem? No, 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 we do not. I said, big country, 1.4 billion people, right? Not much of a drug problem. I said, what do you attribute that to? Well, the death penalty. So, hey, if you're a drug dealer and you know you're going to get caught and you know that you're going to kill people, you're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our families. They're killing our workers. You know, we have a hard time.
So Trump goes on in discussing, that was his appearance in Pennsylvania for the losing candidate there in the special election. And make no mistake, he really wants to do this, folks. And unfortunately, federal law already gives him that ability. You know, they're calling for adding the death penalty for drug dealers. Don't worry, Pfizer, Eli Lilly, Johnson & Johnson. They don't mean you. They mean, you know, black and brown people who deal drugs and poor whites. But they're looking at this drug death penalty. And as I reported, this already exists under federal law. You can look it up on Normal's website. And they write, quote, "The sentence of death can be carried out on a defendant who has been found guilty of manufacturing, importing, or distributing a controlled substance if the act was committed as part of a continuing criminal enterprise, but only if the defendant is the principal administrator, organizer, or leader of the enterprise, or is one of several such principal administrators, organizers, or leaders, and the quantity of the controlled substance is 60,000 kilograms or more of a mixture or substance containing a detectable amount of marijuana, or 60,000 or more marijuana plants, or if the enterprise received more than $20 million in gross receipts during any 12-month period of its existence." Now, that's 18 U.S.C. Section 3591, paragraph B, subparagraph 1. 18 U.S.C. 3591, Section 3591. Now, it may not be constitutional. There was a case in 2008, a case that involved a child rapist that was put to death in Louisiana, where the Supreme Court decided, look, even though child rape's terrible, it's not the end of the kid's life. Only things that end someone's life should be eligible for capital punishment. So that was a distinction made by the majority. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for that. But this drug death penalty already exists, and a lot of people don't know this. Now, is it going to be carried out against marijuana? I don't think so. Probably not. I hate having to think that I'm trusting Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump not to go after pot, but I agree with a lot of people that say there's not a political upside to it and it's too well entrenched and it would be too much of a fight for them to get into. But I'm still also interested in there not being death penalties for people who distribute other drugs. Nobody should be given a death penalty for getting a drug to someone who wanted it. We got to take some, whatever happened to the party of personal responsibility here, right? So I don't want to see death penalty for opioid dealers or coke dealers or fentanyl dealers or any sort of drug dealer. You want to get deeper into it, I don't want to see the death penalty for anybody. I think it's ridiculous to think that you tell people you don't kill by killing them. But that aside, I also want to address some of the hypocrisy about this issue. Because Democrats now are condemning Donald Trump for praising these countries that have the death penalty for drug traffickers, trying to make a big show of how, oh, we're so against the death penalty for drug traffickers. Trump was there, he was saying that the toughness includes the death penalty. And one Democrat already, there's a quote that's out. It's Democratic Senator Ed Markey, one of the two Democrats from Massachusetts. And he said, quote, "We will not incarcerate or execute our way out of the opioid epidemic. Extreme proposals like using the death penalty only perpetuate a harmful stigma associated with opioid use disorders." That was Ed Markey last week. But when Ed Markey was Congressman Ed Markey from Massachusetts, he was one of 189 House Democrats who voted for the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, otherwise known as the Clinton Crime Bill. Title VI of the Clinton Crime Bill was the Federal Death Penalty Act of 1994, which established that the sentence of death may be imposed for, quote, non-homicidal narcotics offenses, end quote. So that very death penalty for drug dealers that I tell you exists in federal law right now and could technically be applied to any successful marijuana business in America, Democrats voted for that, folks. Democrats gave you that law. So yeah, Markey was all for there being the death penalty for drug traffickers when it was part of the Clinton crime bill, when we were still talking about super predators who were prowling our streets, in Hillary Clinton's parlance, when Bill Clinton was effectively using dog whistle politics about being tough on crime and cleaning up the streets and putting more cops on the streets, Democrats almost voted in lockstep for that. Like I said, 189 congresspeople voted, Democratic congresspeople voted for that. And some of them are still in the Congress today. 10 current Democratic senators, including Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, although he's technically independent, voted for the Clinton crime bill when they served in the House. Senators Feinstein from California, Leahy from Vermont, and Murray from Washington State, all three states that have legalized marijuana, they voted yes on the Clinton crime bill when they were in the Senate. And 22 current Democratic congresspeople, including Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, voted yes on the Clinton crime bill when it passed the House. 35 Democrats who are in office today, in Congress today, voted for that Clinton crime bill back in 1994. And it was overwhelmingly a Democratic bill, folks. The final vote in the House for the crime bill was 235 to 195. So 189 Democrats for it, only 46 Republicans were for it. In the Senate, the vote was 61 to 38. And the Democrats made up 54 of those yes votes. So there was still another 7 Republicans that joined them. Overwhelmingly, a Democratic move. Now, to be fair, the Clinton crime bill was a huge bill. Omnibus type of bill. It had lots of stuff in it. But one of the things in it was that Title VI was that death penalty for drug dealers in non-homicidal drug offenses. So I'm very happy that the Democrats of today, the 21st century Democrats, are finding the nerve to oppose harsher criminal penalties for what are truly matters of public health here. It'd be a lot better if they recognized how much of today's opioid overdose epidemic owes to the policies they supported under a Democratic president and then worked to reform them.
Hey, you in my class?
I am today.
All right, that sound means it's 20 after the hour. Happy 420 to our friends in the Mountain Time Zone as we're live here at Delta 9 House and Studios. You can catch us live at MJAgenda.com or on my YouTube channel at Radical Russ. Also, check out the newly redesigned RadicalRuss.com. You can catch all my radical rants and the video replays of this first hour.
The Marijuana Agenda is a listener-supported independent podcast brought to you by Radical Russ Media, LLC. Subscribe to our VIP feed at MJAgenda.com for access to our ad-free podcast segment archive. Make a one-time donation to support the Marijuana Agenda at paypal.me/radicalruss. The Marijuana Agenda. Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaman Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
Whoa, look at Tommy. He's so stoned.
This is totally happening.
Look what's happened to him.
Yeah, this weed is definitely
gross.
Like everyone's doing it.
And it's so uncool.
They think I'm so
out of it. He's really out of it.
If you or someone you care about has a drug problem, call 213-624-DRUG.
This has been an actual anti-drug public service announcement. To combat this and other drug war hysteria, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific at live.mjagenda.com or download the free podcast at mjagenda.com.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
We've got to reestablish first a view that you should say no. People should say no to drug use. They got to protect themselves first.
Whatever you're smoking, it's not marijuana.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
This is Pot in Public Policy. As marijuana legislation continues throughout the United States, it becomes less of an issue of if and when, and more of an issue of how the laws and regulations are crafted. Today, we learn more about the administration and bureaucracy behind ending adult cannabis prohibition with another expert from the world of pot and public policy.
Welcome to another edition of Pot and Public Policy. I'm Russ Belville, and joining us, we have John Hudak, who's from the Brookings Institute. He's a senior fellow for governance studies and the deputy director for the Center for Effective Policy. John, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Boy, it must be quite the time for your line of work, being director of effective public policy and governance studies, given what's going on in Washington, D.C. these days. Has your plate been pretty full, I imagine?
Yeah, it has. The president and his team always keep us occupied when your commitment is public policy and public management and trying to improve it. He's done wonders for the amount of work we have.
I'll bet. Nobody knew they needed you so much until these days, I suppose. But today we're going to talk about an entirely different country, and that is the South American nation of Uruguay, which broke ground in becoming the first nation to set up a legal framework for cannabis. So, John, tell our listeners a little bit about the history of that, and then we'll discuss why we're talking about Uruguay.
Sure. I think actually a lot of people don't realize that Uruguay was the first country to do this. Most people think the Netherlands was the first, but as I'm sure many of your listeners know, you can purchase cannabis in the Netherlands, but the cultivation and sale to those cannabis cafes in the Netherlands is actually illegal. But Uruguay in 2013 passed a law that created an entirely legal system from seed to sale. The president at the time, Mujica, saw this as an important issue surrounding civil rights and human rights, as well as an opportunity to displace black market product that was coming from Paraguay. And even though Mujica ended up not being the president who implemented the law, a new administration that was opposed to the law took over and said, well, we're here to do what the legislature has asked us to do and continued implementation.
Well, that's pretty remarkable, especially comparing and contrasting to the United States, where the Trump administration's come in and tried to pretty much, if it said Obama on it, they wanted to undo it. So kudos to the incoming government of Uruguay for taking on Mujica's proposal and running with it. So this proposal, this law that's in place, that's why we're here discussing it today, is because Brookings, you and a couple of co-authors have put forth a report on the effect of Uruguay's legalization market, the good, the bad, the lessons that we could learn from that. Tell us a little bit about the lessons that we can learn from Uruguay.
Well, a few points about how the system works. It's pretty unique. There are some similarities to systems in American states, but then there are some significant differences as well. So, for instance, you can access cannabis in one of three ways. You can grow it at home. You can belong to a cannabis club, which limits the number of members and the number of plants that can serve those members, or you can buy from the commercial market. And oddly, even though this is non-medical adult use cannabis, you actually have to purchase from the commercial market from pharmacies, which seems a little upside down, but it's how it works. But the unique part about the Uruguayan law is you can only purchase from one of those three forms, one of those three avenues, and you have to register with the state as to which avenue you will use. So if I'm a home grower and I go try to buy it on the commercial market, they'll say to me, sorry, you can't do this. You're not registered in the system in the commercial market. Those are some unique aspects. And it can create some challenges too, especially as the commercial market has run into significant supply shortages from time to time. People then who are registered to purchase from that are left without, in the same way that if you're growing at home and your crops end up getting some sort of parasite or something else happens and the crop is spoiled, you're out of luck. You have to wait until your next grow and your next harvest comes before you can access the market. So those are some challenges that are unique to this exclusive three-avenue set.
And is this sort of like when we're signing up for health insurance and there's a window for which you can register, and if you miss that window, you're stuck with that for, what, a year?
Yeah, so there are windows in which you can register. If you're newly registering, you can register at any time, but you can't constantly be switching back and forth. So it's not as if you can say, oh God, my home grow just went under. Let me run out and register for the commercial market tomorrow so I can get access. There are periods of time in which you as a consumer can switch from one to the other.
Okay, so that does seem problematic for the reasons that you listed. So is it a recommendation of the report that be changed, that people be allowed to access all these points of access rather than just picking one of them?
Yeah, we recommend scrapping the exclusivity rule for the reasons that I had mentioned, but also you have to imagine when you are put into a position where you are your avenue of legal access does not work for you. Like I said, your home grow doesn't work. Let's say the grow at the club that you're affiliated with doesn't work out that cycle, or there's a dramatic product shortage in the commercial market. Most people are still going to want their cannabis. And so it actually incentivizes individuals to pursue black market cannabis, which of course is one of the reasons why the law was passed to undermine that. And so getting rid of the exclusivity rule, I think, is responsive to the realities of the cannabis market while still trying to defeat the black market in Uruguay.
You know, when this was proposed in 2013 and before, they mentioned that they wanted to, you know, undercut the black market, some of this product that was coming from Paraguay and elsewhere. And one of the proposals was to price cannabis as cheaply as possible, as low as $1 a gram. Has that worked out? Have those prices taken effect in Uruguay? And what does your report say about the effectiveness of undercutting the black market with them?
So they do have price ceilings or a fixed price for cannabis sold on the commercial market. It's about $1.40 American a gram, which your listeners know is actually extraordinarily cheap relative to some American prices or really any American price in the commercial market. What ultimately that has done is created a scenario in which it would be difficult to have a system in which you had standard dispensaries that are only really selling cannabis, because that fixed price can't be adjusted by the seller. It's fixed by the government. And so for the pharmacies that are selling this, they're actually not making a lot of money off of this, because not only is the price fixed, but they are limited with regard to how many kilograms they get delivered per month, regardless of demand. And so that puts a cap, a maximum, on the amount of revenue that they can take in a given month or in a given period of time. And it creates financial disincentives for a lot of pharmacies to get into the space.
Here in the United States, some folks are proposing that we need to get away from commercial markets like what we have on the West Coast, Colorado, and some of the eastern states, and maybe move to a more nonprofit model, maybe a model of Spanish-style cultivation clubs. As you look at the compare and contrast between, you know, American commercial legal marijuana and Uruguay's state-run system with these price caps, is there a sweet spot somewhere in between that you recommend that we should be looking at?
You know, I would say that for a variety of reasons, Uruguayan cannabis is probably priced a bit too low in order to get the market really moving to create the types of economic incentives from the seller's perspective that could be there with higher prices. But I think you're right, and most of your listeners would agree, that American prices in some states is prohibitively high as well. And so I think there is somewhere in the middle. The challenge, of course, is while many Americans and particularly cannabis consumers want cannabis at cheaper prices, the vast majority of Americans want heavily regulated cannabis. And of course, regulation is passed on to the consumer at the price point. And so it's this balancing act between well-regulated, diversified product that's safe, that an individual knows what they're consuming, versus getting it at a lower price point in ways that make the consumer happier, but also help displace the black market. I think there is some middle ground there, prices lower than the U.S., but higher than Uruguay's, but neither system has yet figured that out.
And is there other limitation on the commercial cannabis? I think I had read somewhere that they were limited to the selection of strains that they were growing, or that they were somehow government strains, and if you had some other type of cannabis, it was illegal. Can you clear that up for me?
Yeah, so they're not exactly government strains. The strains are produced by private companies. So there are two private companies, ICC and Symbiosis, in Uruguay, who have contracts with the government to cultivate cannabis. So this is even a little bit different than just getting a license from the government. It's a true government contract. And they have put forward, each have put forward two strains of cannabis that have been approved by the government. So they're not government created strains, but they are government approved strains. In the same way that, you know, strains or product in the United States in commercial markets gets approved in states that have product testing labs. And so you know that they're clean of bacteria and mold, you know they're clean of heavy metals and things like that. But the among the four strains, the THC range is between 2% and 9%. So you're not seeing the higher levels of THC on the commercial market in Uruguay like you would see in Nevada or Oregon or Washington.
So these strains that have been approved through these government contractors, I guess the Boeing and the Northrop Grumman of weed, whoever they might be, is that a limitation that also applies to the people that are growing in the cannabis clubs or growing for their own purposes? Are they limited on what choices they have?
They're not. So as long as they are growing product within the limits that exist, and so for a club, depending on how many members you have, the maximum you have, you can have is 99 plants, and your members are allotted only a certain number of grams per month. But as long as you're doing that, you can have higher potency cannabis. You could have different ratios of cannabinoids, different strains, et cetera. You're not restricted just to those four strains that have been approved by the government for the commercial market.
Well, that's good news. Now, what about other sorts of cannabis products? Is there anything in the way of edibles, topicals, lotions, tinctures, extracts, concentrates like that?
There's not. So the commercial market in Uruguay, you get whole flower marijuana. And I've seen it, you know, as a non-Uruguayan, I'm not able to purchase it. But I have seen from consumers who have purchased it, they've opened the package and showed me it is true whole flower marijuana. It's not the type of pulverized marijuana that you see in some medical markets. And so you're getting that. But no, there is not now a market for other types of products like vapes and edibles, et cetera.
The report's out at Brookings. It's about the Uruguayan market. And can you tell us the name of the report and your co-author so if people are looking for it, they can find it?
Yeah, absolutely. The report is called Uruguay's Cannabis Law, Pioneering a New Paradigm. And I'm an author as well as Jeff Ramsey and John Walsh, who are both at WOLA, the Washington Office on Latin America.
Fantastic. And let's wrap this up with a look at what the results have been for society. I mean, part of the fears of legalizing marijuana would be, you know, increased crime or more kids are using or all these scare tactics that have been thrown at us. What have the public health information officials in Uruguay had to say about the results of legalization?
So one of the limitations actually with the current law is that there hasn't been as stern of a mandate for data collection around these issues. And so the main regulatory body for this is called the IRCA. The IRCA generally translates to the Institute for Regulating and Controlling Cannabis. And it is, they have really begun to work with other ministries to collect data on public health and public safety issues, youth use, et cetera. But it's important to note, while the law was passed in 2013, commercial sales just began this past summer, and so late summer. And so we don't have, this is the answer I give you a lot of times when I'm on the show, we just don't have the data yet. There hasn't been enough of time of data collection or even the opportunity to collect data. And while the cannabis clubs and the home grow markets have been up and running for quite some time, the commercial market really hasn't been. And so I think in a year or so, we're going to have a better idea about some of these public health and public safety effects. I'll tell you, I've been down there twice working on this project. I'm not seeing cars flying off bridges and children smoking weed in the streets. And so anecdotally, I can tell you it doesn't seem like a dramatically changed Uruguay. When I was down there the first time, the commercial market was not up and running yet. When I was down there the second time, it was up and running. I didn't see many effects. We talked to people and asked if they had seen many effects, and it seems not to have happened yet. But again, we'll know more in the future.
All right. Well, we'll be back in touch in a year and get an update on what's happening in South America's and at this point, the world's only legalized country. Canada's following on their heels this summer. We'll see how that turns out as well. John Hudak from Brookings Institute. It's brookings.edu if you're looking for the website. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with all your endeavors.
Russ, as always, thanks a ton.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is brought to you by Cannabis Kamikaze, a professional licensed producer from Canada producing 3 pounds per light. Follow Cannabis Kamikaze on Twitter at Cannabis Kamikaze. That's at Cannabis, K-A-M-I-K-A-Z, Cannabis Kamikaze.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 1920s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stopped arresting responsible marijuana smokers. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
Hi, my name is Ricky Williams.
My name is Evan Britton.
My name is Marcus Stelly.
My name is Boo Williams.
My name is Jim McMahon.
My name is Chris Cluey.
My name is Kyle Turley. I played in one of the major North American football leagues.
I have 2 championship rings from that big game we play at the end of the season.
In college, I won a trophy that looks like this.
I was a punter for 8 seasons, and punters are football players too.
I also wrote the name of the commissioner on my headband, and everyone lost their shit.
The men who play American football are subject to a life of injury,
pain,
and disease,
both during and long after their careers are over.
And that's why I smoke pot.
That's why I smoke cannabis.
That's why I smoke weed. That's why I smoked weed when I played.
It has, without a doubt, reduced the amount of pain I live with.
It's my body. I know. But for some reason, the major North American non-Canadian football league refuses to allow players to use cannabis.
Instead of allowing for safe, natural healing, the sport pushes players towards addictive, narcotic painkillers with serious side effects.
So let's get real, Roger.
Football players should be allowed to use medicinal marijuana.
Without the stigma of it being a banned substance. Cannabis isn't a drug.
It is a medicine.
And now, another episode of Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre. I'm your host, Leonard Pinth-Garnell III. Tonight we revel in the hilarity of acquiring cannabis when miscommunication occurs between the cannabis delivery service and the consumer. The Royal Shakespearean Cannabis Theatre Company presents the classic David's Not Present piece, made famous by Richard Merrin and Thomas Chong. Enjoy.
Hark. Who goes there?
It is I, David. Pray grant me immediate passage, good sir. I come bearing a package of great import.
Hark! Who goes there?
It is I, David, as I previously informed you. Make haste in unlatching this portal, for I believe the constable hath cast his visage upon me. I bring you the package you seek.
'Tis David?
Affirmative, my good man. 'Tis David. Now open this door forthwith.
David's not present.
For Cannabis Shakespearean Theatre, I'm Leonard Pythgornell III.
Yar, there be pirates here. Yo, ho, 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 and a ton of good smoke. Har, har.
Health Cannabinoid, your ACMPR experts. Consultation services for medical cannabis. Visit healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. That's www.healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. Health Cannabinoid.
Activism begins with ACT. The Marijuana Agenda features the stories of hardworking grassroots activists working for an end to prohibition in today's activist agenda.
Welcome to another edition of the Activist Agenda. I'm Russ Belville, and joining us today from her moving vehicle in Idaho, the landlocked prohibition state, the only CBD veto state, we've got Sarah Frank joining us from Idaho Hemp Fest, or Boise Hemp Fest. I'm not sure which one we're calling it now, but Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Russ.
Is it Boise Hemp Fest or Idaho Hemp Fest?
Boise Hemp Fest.
Okay, so that's the first thing we need to talk about, because that's coming up really soon here. You guys are one of the first hemp fests on the activist schedule for 2018. Tell folks about the history of the Boise Hemp Fest and what they can expect this year.
Well, Boise Hemp Fest started off in 2011 as the Idaho Hope Fest.
That's where I'm getting confused. I understand.
And it was, you know, in line with the Seattle Hemp Fest and the Moscow, Idaho Hemp Fest. And we just wanted to put on the same type of event and provide information and education to people in Boise. So it began 2011, 2012 with Idaho Hope Fest. We couldn't even say Hemp Fest at that point. We had to say HOPE, which stood for Hemp Offers People Everything. And after a couple of years...
Wait, hold on. Why couldn't you say hemp? Was it a problem with the parks or the permitting system?
We felt that it was a problem with everything. You know, there was such a stigma, especially back then. And, you know, I say back then, but it was not even 10 years ago. But it was such a stigma to people that people just kind of balked at, you know, the word marijuana, the word hemp, anything to do with cannabis.
So as legalization happened next door, Washington and Oregon, and that has helped a bit, I suppose, to be able to at least even say the word hemp.
Yes. We feel definitely more comfortable. The people we encounter are more comfortable. Everybody knows about cannabis now. It's not the same type of reefer madness, just say no stigma that it has. And yes, it definitely is attributed to the rest of the world.
So switching from a Hope Fest to a Hemp Fest, that's where you guys get involved with Viv McPeak and the folks up at Seattle, right?
Yes. Seattle Hemp Fest comes down and has a booth and speaks. You know, they have several different speakers, Sharon Whitson. We've worked really closely with Vivian and Steve Sun and Cyril and getting everything done so that we can, you know, make it like a Seattle Hemp Fest type event. A protestival with lots of education and freedom.
It's been a fantastic event. I've been able to be there, I think, at each one of the Boise Hemp Fest so far. And the park that you're having at, Julia Davis Park, it's a wonderful location because you got this built-in band shell for the speakers and for the band. So it's not like you're having to have a whole lot of stage setup expense like they do in Seattle. And you've got kind of a amphitheater sort of setup for people to relax. And, of course, early April and mid-April in Boise can be a little brisk, but it's usually pretty nice weather out there. So what do we got going for the Boise Hemp Fest this year as far as band speakers or events or displays that people can look at?
Well, we have 10 entertainers. this year. We have 8 bands, a belly dancer troupe, and a fire dancer troupe again. And then we have the Enchanted Forest, which is an educational display setup, or, you know, a place that people can just walk through and read and learn. And this year, I believe we're going to have kind of a mini symposium where speakers can sit down and chat with, you know, people walking through the Enchanted Forest and help answer their questions and tell them what, you know, we know about cannabis as opposed to what we're taught about cannabis in Idaho. And then we have many speakers. We've had the fortune to have so many great speakers over the last few years. We've had like Megan Holt coming down and speaking about her daughter, Maddie, who, you know, if nobody knows that story, it's definitely one to follow. She uses cannabis to help treat a very rare syndrome. And it actually has extended Maddie's life. Of course, you know, we love that we have a new MC, Russ Belleville. And
thank you.
I think that that is a huge part of what draws people to our events is the amount of education that is given, you know, just openly and freely from the stage and everywhere they look. People in Idaho want to know about cannabis. And it's definitely something that, you know, they want to talk about.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's difficult in a state like Idaho where, you know, there's so much repression over this kind of issue. As I did the intro and I said, it's Idaho's, you know, the only CBD veto state. And for folks that don't know what that means, it means that next door in Utah, where, you know, you'd think Utah is the most conservative possible state around Idaho. Utah started by allowing epileptic kids to use the CBD oil that's not psychoactive. And then a whole bunch of other states in the South and the Midwest that, you know, they hate pot as much as anybody, but they hate sick little kids dying worse. And so they passed these CBD bills. A CBD bill came to Idaho, and it got through the House, got through the Senate, got to the governor's desk. And Butch Otter, the outgoing governor, is the only one in the nation to have looked at sick kids and said, yeah, no, I'm going to veto it. So this is a tough state to be able to get anything done. And I bring this up to let people know that if you're thinking about coming out to support Boise Hemp Fest, coming out to Idaho and making your voice heard, leave your smoke at home.
Yes, it's definitely not a friendly state. Although, you know, we don't find any resistance with the city or the Parks Department. We have a good rapport going on with the police, and the Idaho State Police. And it's really just, you can see the change in the last 10 years. And I believe in the future, it'll be a lot more open and free, and they'll value it the same way they value their breweries.
Well, we should certainly hope so. I mean, there's aside from just the madness of locking people up over growing and consuming a plant, there's the tragedy of, like I said, those sick kids that could use this medicine, the adults that could use the medicine, and not just CBD, but whole plant cannabis. So let's pivot a little bit and talk about the activism going on in Idaho and the reforms that you are trying to achieve there. I understand there is a CBD bill in Idaho again, but this time there's some shenanigans going on. I reported on this where it's just hard to believe that the chairman of a committee just took everybody in secret and gave them a dressing down about, you know, we're not going to hear this bill. The governor doesn't want to hear this bill. Here, let me play that clip for everyone.
We're not going to hear this issue on my committee. There's other issues on the agenda. It's totally inappropriate. Look. The governor's office does not want to hear this bill. The drug policy does not want to hear this bill. Prosecutors do not want to hear this bill. State police do not want to hear this bill. And I'm respecting those people. And I told the governor we did not hear the bill in our committee.
So can you believe that? I mean, the chairman right there just coming right out and saying it. The governor doesn't want this bill. And I respect those people, not the people of Idaho that want this bill to pass, but law enforcement and rehab and the governor. And this just has to drive you crazy.
Oh, it does. Yes. Especially, you know, all the people you just named are all the people who are throwing money at them. And if we had the money, we'd throw it too, you know, but we're sick citizens. We're sick patients in Idaho, or we have sick kids, and we don't have that opportunity to throw a bunch of money at our governor so that he'll sign that bill.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have to be that way either, you know. And so we've started a new movement. It's more of a, you know, a collaboration of all the movements that have happened in Idaho so far, and we're calling it Legalize Idaho. And it's to put pressure on our state. It's to put pressure on our citizens to get involved and demand this and take it back, because that's the most powerful thing about the initiative process, is that we, as people, as citizens of the state of Idaho, we have the right to say, no, we reject what our Congress is doing, we reject what our governor is doing, and we demand that this law be changed, because it's something that is, we're passionate about. And obviously, it's something that everybody's passionate about. I mean, for that committee to be heard from behind closed doors arguing about a CBD bill, and for reporters to be the one to call them out on the legality of that kind of situation, just shows that even they are extremely passionate. There are people in there arguing with them saying, no, it's not the governor's decision. You know, and those are the legislators that we need to support.
Absolutely. And this is an important point, that Idaho does have the citizen initiative power that only 24 states have. And that's how most of the states have passed their marijuana law reforms initially. And I understand they're trying to tighten that down a little bit, though, as far as signature gathering requirements. Has that change actually happened yet?
I have not heard of an official change yet. We are watching and waiting, and you know, we, of course, will overcome any obstacle that they throw at us.
There's, yeah. This is something. This is pretty typical when the people in power start to see that the people have figured out the initiative system and are going to use it to pass something they don't like. They start to come up with all these hurdles that make the initiative power that much more difficult. And I believe the one being proposed in Idaho is like you have to get X percent of signatures from each district or county or whatever it might be. And so what that does is, you know, people in Idaho, you know, the majority of the people in the state live in the Boise, Nampa, Caldwell area, this, you know, 2 or 3 county area of the state. And so if you're gathering signatures, well, you'd put your time and resources there into the Boise metro area. So they say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make this tougher for you. We're going to make you go out to Firth. We're going to make you go out to Salmon. We're going to make you go to Riggins. We're going to go to these way flung out places in Idaho in the hinterlands to collect X number of signatures. And if you're a small organization with a tight budget, that's just more gas money, more hotel money, more signature gathering money that you got to spend. So I'd encourage the people of Idaho looking at this, you know, to contact your representatives and say, no, don't tinker with the initiative system. We should have an initiative system that represents the majority of the people, no matter where they live. So we'll keep an eye on that. We'll keep an eye on the CBD bill that's getting through. I understand Butch Otter is term limited, thank God. And the Republican primary is starting to heat up there in Idaho with Raul Labrador, the current congressman, called out the Senate on their shenanigans, you know, the closed door thing. And you got a Tommy Ahlquist there running, who's a Republican who's for the CBD. So you're even starting to see this change in the Republican politics in Idaho, aren't you?
Yes. Butch Otter made the decision to not run again because he was being considered for Trump's choice for the director of agriculture, I believe, or the AG. I don't remember, but that's why he left. And then somebody else was picked. So it was the luckiest thing that happened to Idaho, because Butch Otter is gone at the end of this year. And that's, I see all the doors opening. I see many candidates who are very interested, and we're actually going to be trying to get them to come to our cannabis town hall this fall to debate that, to talk about their viewpoints. Paulette Jordan up in northern Idaho, she's another big Democratic candidate that is supportive, and we just see a lot of hope, you know, come in for Idaho.
Well, that's a good thing, and you know, considering that you're surrounded, we'll continue that interview with Sarah Frank in hour two of our show, but for hour one, we are just about out of time. So my thanks to John Hudak and to Sarah Frank for being guests on our hour one free podcast. Stay tuned. Hour two is next. And you podcast listeners, for $4.20 a month, you can get your exclusive hour two podcast feed.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
Berwyn here at Delta 9 House of Studios. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers. You're growing, you're trying, you're rolling, you're strong, yeah. You take a seat, you're planning.